Hello and welcome. I'm Ben Schultz.
I'm Nora Schultz.
And you're listening to Trying to Adapt, and today we're trying to adapt to Notre Dame de Paris, or Esmeralda, a lyrical drama in four acts, by William Henry Fry.
This is yet another opera. However, interesting to note, this is the first American adaptation, and it's also the first adaptation that's called Notre Dame of Paris. Obviously it has the Esmeralda title in there as well.
Yeah, this is the first adaptation we've looked at, whether we did an episode on it or not, that isn't titled some variation of just Esmeralda. This was originally produced in 1864 in Philadelphia during the middle of the Civil War. The original production was for the benefit of the Sanitary Commission of the Army and Navy of the United States.
Little interesting things to note. We didn't have an audio recording of this to listen to, but we did read the script. And in the script cast list, Frollo is listed as the astrologer to the king, which I don't think ever comes up in the opera.
He is also mentioned as an archdeacon, and that's something that I think we said in the first couple episodes is actually pretty rare in adaptations for him to be a priest of some kind, because a lot of people who were making adaptations didn't want to piss off the church.
Well, yeah, and here's like an example of an adaptation that is coming from, you know, a society that's less affected by the power of the Catholic Church. They're not really going to do that much about an American opera.
But so you mentioned the cast list. In the cast list, there are actually only six characters. We have Dom Frollo, not Claude, just Dom Frollo.
Dom marking his favorite sex position.
De Chateaupeur. No Phoebus. He's never referred to as Phoebus in the entire thing. It's just De Chateaupeur, which is kind of crazy because I'm pretty sure you're not supposed to put de in there because it's like the French version of if there's nothing before it.
His name is of Chateaupeur.
They didn't care. Quasimodo, Esmeralda, Florian, who once again is a character who's been added in to serve as kind of the sidekick to Phoebus, or in this case, not Phoebus.
Yeah, apparently people were reading this book and really thinking like, okay, so we know about Phoebus, but God, I'm just dying to know more about the other soldiers in medieval Paris. And so they created OCs. Also in this cast list, Quasimodo is listed as the, quote, former dependent of Frollo. I feel like that's kind of a spoiler.
Kinda, although I'm pretty sure the audience going in isn't reading the cast list.
I mean, fair, but it does just seem like kind of a weird thing to put.
I don't think this was in the playbill.
Probably not. I just thought it was kind of a weird thing to put in there.
And lastly, we have Gudule, who you may remember as the sack lady. So this is actually an adaptation where they kept that plot line in, but they did make some significant changes to it, and we'll get into that.
Yeah, they made it make a lot less sense, or have a lot less, like, dramatic build-up. This adaptation actually keeps in the part about, like, how this opening festival is supposed to be for the Dauphine getting married to, was it Margaret of Flanders?
I don't think that's how it happens in the book. I don't think there's a royal wedding taking place.
But yeah, there is.
I mean, they have, like, a big festival with lots of diplomats from other countries, but I don't think...
Yeah, but isn't it about... It's about the Dauphine getting married, isn't it? Because I remember in Pierre Gringoire's weird little play, he made that, like, pun about, like, the dolphin.
Yeah, I think you're right. In any case, Pierre Gringoire is not here, and neither is the play.
And neither is fucking Jeanne, but I'm used to that at this point. Also, now this whole celebration just takes place in the square in front of Notre Dame, even though it isn't like a religious celebration, really.
And then we're introduced pretty much right away to Esmeralda, who sings a song. And usually the first song that Esmeralda sings in adaptations like these is about how, like, oh, she looks so happy, but on the inside she's really actually very sad. In this version, we don't get that. She's just like, yes, I love being a gypsy, la la la.
To be fair, in the book, like, we don't really get a sense of Esmeralda's true feelings. I mean, like, she's kind of bummed about the fact that she doesn't know who her parents are, but otherwise, like...
And in this version, that whole thing about her not knowing who her parents are is included, but she doesn't seem to be particularly bothered by it, at least not yet.
She doesn't let it get her down. Also, one thing I find kind of interesting is that they refer to Esmeralda not only as a gypsy, but as, like, a Zingara and other, like, terms for, like, a Romani woman. What I was thinking about is, I feel like, especially in these operas where the focus is Esmeralda, there's always this element of, like, this exotified, like, you know. I think what I'm trying to say is that I was thinking about how, for the majority of the American audience, the element that Esmeralda is a gypsy is, like, probably was even more of a, like, exotic trait about her than it would be for European audiences. Even though, of course, she winds up not being Romani, but I don't know, I feel like they kind of play that up a little bit, because I think that, like, yeah, I think that would have been considered even more exotic by American audiences than European audiences, who already were drawn to this story because, like, ooh, gypsies are so mysterious.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. I definitely think that compared to the other things that we've looked at, there's less of an expectation for the audience to know anything in particular about gypsies. I don't think they're really cast as, like, quite as negative as they usually are.
Yeah, the exotic element here is kind of both a good thing and a bad thing, in the sense that, yeah, I mean, I do feel like there is less, you know, like, Esmeralda is a gypsy, therefore she's a witch, or, like, therefore all her fellow gypsies are thieves, because I think there was less of a public conception about Romani people in America, and still is today.
Yeah, so we're introduced then to Gudule, the sack lady, who shows up along with the soldiers looking for her daughter. And this is kind of interesting because in the book, if you'll remember, she had kind of barricaded herself inside kind of a makeshift prison cell and refused to leave or do anything. In this version, she just kind of seems to be wandering around France asking people if they've seen her daughter.
Yeah, she's extremely casual about it in this one and doesn't really seem, like, too big into the whole penance idea. She just kind of, even though it's been 16 years, she's still just like, hey, has anyone seen my daughter? I mean, I don't know what she looks like now, because she was a baby when I lost her, but, you know, any 16-year-old girls you happen to know?
So she goes up to Florian to ask him, and Florian kind of tells her to ask Phoebus, and Phoebus somehow, literally right away, is like, wouldn't it be crazy if Esmeralda were actually this woman's daughter? And then, like, they just leave that alone for the next three acts.
Yeah, because, like, at this event, too, Phoebus meets Esmeralda. And, like, normally, I mean, these operas always kind of turn Phoebus into this, like, romantic hero that he totally is not. Like, in the book, he's basically a direct subversion of that. No, in these operas, Phoebus is always, like, 100% in love with Esmeralda. Usually, like, it takes a couple seconds. Like, here, Phoebus and Esmeralda just kind of meet at this event in front of Notre Dame. And, like, instantly, Phoebus is like, here, take my purse.
Yeah, and even when he suggests to the sack lady that Esmeralda might actually be her daughter, I don't know if he really, like, believes that, because it definitely seems like he's just using it as an opportunity to be like, oh, time to think about how hot Esmeralda is for a minute.
Yeah, I also think that it might be a consequence of Phoebus having, like, the intelligence and, like, memory span of a goldfish. Like, oh, I just met a 16-year-old girl. What a crazy coincidence.
And in this case, you know, because he turns out to actually be right, I have one more note about this scene, and it is the fact that this is obviously rhyming because it's an opera. Chateau Pur is apparently supposed to rhyme with quarters. Chateaupers. So this is when Frollo shows up. in this adaptation, as in many other adaptations, it's changed so that Esmeralda actually knows who Frollo is and that he's been, like, stalking her for a while and she's been trying to get away from him for a while. This is actually a pretty good line. He says to her, "Be my angel, else I thy devil."
Yeah, I mean, it is basically just, like, a ye olde English way of, like, repeating the words of, like, a 12-year-old emo kid's wall. What I really like about this is that normally we have Frollo announcing his love to Esmeralda at, like, a dramatic moment. Not here. The first thing that we know about Frollo in this one is that he's trying to get with Esmeralda. Like, he is not slick about this. Someone could easily just be overhearing this conversation and be like, "What? The Archdeacon's into chicks now?"
Yeah, in this version, he comes off as kind of like a typical catcalling guy.
Yeah, he's just publicly harassing Esmeralda. Like, she's got fans.
And then Phoebus steps in and he's like, "You know, Esmeralda, if you've got guys like these following you around all the time, how about you let me come back to your place tonight so I can protect you?
How about you let a guy like me follow you around all the time?"
Yeah, really. So Quasimodo is crowned the King of Fools and he's paraded around. And as always, Frollo shows up to collect him. And a lot of the time it's presented as this kind of thing where, like, oh, Frollo won't let him leave the church and he snuck out on his own. In this version, Frollo gives us a very specific reason for why he doesn't want Quasimodo to be the King of Fools that isn't just you have to stay under lock and key in the church all the time. He's legitimately embarrassed by the fact that someone who he's raised from a very young age would choose to kind of debase himself in front of a crowd of people like this. It brings him shame to watch Quasimodo accept, quote, "the admiration of this vile rabble."
I honestly feel like that's probably the reason that Frollo had in the book, too. I don't think he really tells Quasimodo why he's angry. I mean, like, Victor Hugo tells us that they kind of, like, sign it out, and then they just leave, and everyone's like, "Huh, that was interesting."
Yeah, so in this version, not only is there, like, a specific reason for Frollo coming to take Quasimodo away, we actually get to find out what it is.
Yeah, I honestly feel like that's pretty in character. That doesn't surprise me, given what we know about Frollo from the book.
I think that's good, because it brings kind of like a character development angle to Frollo that a lot of adaptations don't really bother to do, because, like, well, he's the villain, we can just make him out. Like, his only character trait is that he's a lecher.
Yeah, because I feel like that kind of simultaneously brings up the complexity of the parental relationship he has with Quasimodo, which a lot of adaptations kind of leave out entirely. It's a parental concern, but it is also him being kind of selfish and, you know, obsessed with a certain sort of purity that I think fits well with his character.
Now, speaking of Frollo's parental relationship with Quasimodo, there's also a part where he says something along the lines of, "Not 15 summers had passed through my life when I first adopted you." So, wait a minute. He was 14 years old?
Yeah, I was like, wait a second. Claude Frollo was 14 years old when he decided to just casually adopt a deformed baby?
I guess that's just how they did things in medieval France, when a 14-year-old shows up and is like, "I would like to adopt this deformed baby."
I mean, that's basically what happens in the book, except he's 19, which I think is a more acceptable age for sudden baby adoption. Wow. Yeah, I read that too, and I did take a note of that, because that's interesting. Yeah, so after Frollo yells at Quasimodo, everyone, like, starts attacking Frollo, which, like, that's not in the book. They all just, like, they know not to mess with Frollo and Quasimodo.
Well, see, that's the thing, is he's wearing a cloak, and so they don't realize that it's Frollo right away, and as soon as one of the people who's attacking him, like, pulls off his cloak and then reveals that it's Frollo, and everyone's like, "Oh shit, Frollo, he's gonna cast spells on us," or
Yeah, they see Frollo, and they're like, "A dangerous sorcerer."
Now, I just have to point out, the end of Act 1 here is that Phoebus and Esmeralda are still here, and as soon as Frollo reveals himself, Phoebus is like, Don't worry, Esmeralda. No matter what Frollo tries to do to you, I'm going to protect you from his magic. And then that's the end of the act. So I don't know what happened there.
You know, all those things that Phoebus is. Soldier, 16-year-old baby tracker, warlock. So Act 2 has Quasimodo hanging out in his special bell space. I don't know exactly. I don't think this is a very popular adaptation. I don't think it's an adaptation that had necessarily a lot of effect.
Oh, well, the only reason we were even able to read the script is that someone just, like, found a copy tucked away in some library and digitized it. This is not, like, something that was...
This isn't a prominent opera. I do find interesting, though, that this is the first adaptation that we've closely looked at where I get the idea of, like, Quasimodo kind of, like, feeling trapped in his, like... being up in the tower, looking down at the people, feeling like he isn't a part of society, and like that, the sort of image that people associate with Quasimodo. He wants to live in a society, but at the same time, I like that this one also kind of keeps book Quasimodo, like he, in the book, Quasimodo, I feel, like, is upset that he does not live in a society, but also rejects that society at the same time. He doesn't really want to be a part of it because of how cruel it's been to him. Quasimodo here describes himself as, quote, a recording angel looking on at, quote, mortal good and evil. Which, like, if you are an outcast from society and you get to spend all of your time in a very tall and very beautiful tower, I think that that is, like, the sickest possible way to imagine yourself. And I really appreciate that energy.
So Quasimodo has this moment where he is clearly depressed about the way that society has treated him. And then he kind of goes, well, at least I have my bells.
Which is kind of like book Quasimodo, too. Frollo actually visits Quasimodo in the Belfry, which, like, that's a bit of an interesting element. So Frollo goes to visit Quasimodo in his special bell space, and, like, when he tells Quasimodo, you know, that he is in love with Esmeralda, but, like, she won't love him back, Quasimodo, I don't know if, like, he's doing this a bit sarcastically. I mean, I think at this point Quasimodo does have genuine admiration for his weird dad since he was 14. Since the dad was 14. Because he has this instant response is like, why would someone reject you? As I put it in my notes, Quasimodo is surprised by the idea of someone rejecting his hot and very smart, scary dad.
I imagine Frollo is like, come on.
Frollo's like, okay, now you're just kissing ass, Quasimodo.
But so, as in previous adaptations, Quasimodo is also in love with Esmeralda, and when Frollo tells him about...
We haven't seen the watering of the hunchback in a while.
No. That was something that I predicted would be in basically every adaptation, because it's one of the most iconic scenes from the book.
Yeah, that and, like, Sanctuary. But apparently, like, the 1800s operas were like, nah.
It is, after all, Esmeralda in many of these, and not the Hunchback of Notre Dame, and I think we'll probably see a very clear distinction between, just looking at the title, between Esmeraldas and Hunchbacks.
Yeah, they're practically two different stories, which is a really interesting, like, first book for us to, like, sink our teeth into.
So, as I was saying, Quasimodo finds out that Frollo is in love with Esmeralda, and he's like, well, I also love Esmeralda. And so as soon as he finds this out, he starts kind of hatching a plan to sabotage Frollo's plan to kidnap Esmeralda. So in this adaptation, the inn that Phoebus and Esmeralda go to kind of make love is not included. As in the last adaptation we looked at, it's Esmeralda's house, which is above the river.
Good for Esmeralda for being a homeowner at such a young age in this economy.
Yeah, especially since Pierre Gringoire is not a character.
Yeah, no, she just lives completely by herself, 16-year-old Romani girl in 1482. Yes, queen.
So this is important because Frollo's plan is to row a boat down the river to her house and just kind of sneak in and take her away in the boat. And unbeknownst to Frollo, he's doing this at the same time that Phoebus is going to Esmeralda's house for kind of their date. So we move on to the next scene where it's at the soldiers' barracks, and Florian is like, gee, I wonder what's going on with Phoebus and his date. I hope everything's all right.
Yeah, so on this first date, Phoebus, like, straight up proposes marriage to her, which, like, if you'll remember from the book, Esmeralda kind of, like, assumes that he's going to marry her, and he basically, like, laughs behind her back about it. So I've talked a little bit before about how, like, we're in these adaptations where Phoebus is, like, this romantic character, he's also, like, portrayed as, like, a woke king, because, like, I don't care if you're dirty and Romani. But in this one, like, he already believes her to just be a white girl. So, like, instead, he's just like, you know, I don't care if you're poor.
And at the same time, Esmeralda is saying to the audience, like, oh, I don't know if he really loves me or if he's just trying to trick me. I'm a gypsy girl. Why would this guy ever want to marry me? And so basically she is making him confirm multiple times that, yes, he really does love her and he really does want to marry her.
Right after this, the stage direction reads, enter Frollo and Quasimodo in a boat. Now, I really want to know how this is done on stage. For now, I'm going to choose to believe that, like, they're carrying, like, a woodcut, an outline of the side of a boat and just kind of, like, carrying it along with them.
I was hoping that maybe the theater just starts to fill with water. Maybe both at the same time.
Both, and they start to drown. This adaptation uses a lot of, like, thees and thous. They keep rhyming thee with itself. And that's when it stopped being charming for me. That was where my, like, oh, it's kind of cute. Like, it wasn't cute anymore.
While this is going on, Frollo and Quasimodo realize that Phoebus is staying over at her house. And they're like, oh, shit, should we really go through with this if he's here? And in the meantime, Esmeralda has been thoroughly convinced that Phoebus really does love her. And so she goes, like, well, you can have the amulet that my mother gave me before I disappeared as a child, and the dagger that one of the older gypsies gave me to protect me. You can take these things because I trust you. And Phoebus is basically going like, all right, so tomorrow morning I'm going to go talk to the sack lady and find out if she recognizes this thing.
Even though she isn't the sack lady in this version, she's a concerned mother who, for some reason, thinks that this random, kind of dumb Paris cop is going to help her find her 16-year-old baby.
I just like referring to her as the sack lady, by the way. I know that her name is Gadul, Sister Gadul, whatever her name was in the book.
She has a lot of different names in the book.
Just to keep things consistent, I like to refer to her as the sack lady. Just like how Phoebus is never referred to as Phoebus in this adaptation, he's always referred to as Captain de Chateaupeur, but I'm calling him Phoebus anyway because you, the listener, know who Phoebus is.
In my notes, I've started referring to Phoebus as Fee because of the last adaptation. So, as always, Esmeralda faints after Phoebus gets stabbed. You would think that, you know, like, her fainting would make it, like, easier to, like, take her into the boat. Instead, they hear the popo coming, get scared, and just leave. The soldiers rush in. They find Phoebus. It's already clear that he is still alive. Like, Florian, whoever, is like, wow, Phoebus is still alive.
No. There is a moment where, like, he's just lying down, and Florian's like, oh my god, Phoebus is dead. And then literally, like, seconds later, Phoebus just, like, gets up, and he's mostly fine.
Yeah, so Phoebus is clearly alive, and yet
I think I can see why people used to get buried alive a lot in the past.
They're immediately calling Esmeralda a murderess. A murder has decidedly not happened.
Yeah, and so Phoebus kind of, like, wakes up. He's still groggy from fainting and getting stabbed, and he's like, oh man, what's going on with Esmeralda? And then he passes out again.
Typical Phoebus.
So if he could have just held it together with regards to being conscious for like 10 more seconds, none of the rest of the story would have happened.
I'm now convinced that having characters that normally, like, would never interact just walk into each other's homes is, like, just a 19th century theater thing. Because Quasimodo and Gadul just walk into Phoebus's house. I'm not sure how either of them know his address. And Quasimodo just kind of casually reveals that he has Esmeralda's amulet, as if that isn't, like, proof that he was involved in the whole Phoebus situation. Like, Phoebus isn't gonna be like, wait a second, buddy. That's the amulet she gave me before I got stabbed.
Yeah, so Esmeralda ends up going on trial, and it's not a murder trial. They know that Phoebus is still alive. They're not even trying her for murder.
The sentence is death anyways.
Frollo basically says, like, yeah, she's a sorceress. He's not even there. We don't even get to see him make the accusation. At some point between Act 2 and Act 3, Frollo tells somebody that Esmeralda's a sorceress, and this is enough for them to go on to just, like, okay, tomorrow we're gonna hang you.
And even though everyone already thinks that Frollo himself is a dangerous sorcerer.
Well, he would know, right?
We have yet another scene where Frollo dramatically confesses his love to Esmeralda, you know, in exchange for not dying. But this already happened. We already, both Esmeralda and the audience, have been knew that Frollo was in love with Esmeralda. Not even from, like, context clues, but because he outright says it in the first act.
Meanwhile, Phoebus is talking to the sack lady, and as soon as he shows up, she's like, oh man, I heard you went out with a gypsy last night. I sure hope everything's okay, because as you will recall from the book, she's incredibly racist. And that's when he shows her the amulet. So basically he gets to be like the Maury Povich type here and be like, yeah, that's right, that gypsy you're super racist towards is actually your daughter. And she just kind of, like, forgets the whole thing immediately and goes immediately into, like, well, where is she? Can I talk to her right now?
I like that also, until this point, Phoebus hasn't really, like, been doing much to try to help Esmeralda. You know, he's just kind of like, well, you see.
Oh, and I forgot to mention that Quasimodo is also there while this is going on, and the reason that he's there is because he took the amulet from Phoebus's passed out body. And then he felt bad about it, and he's like, I gotta go find Phoebus and return this to him.
Well, that's why I said it's so weird that Phoebus isn't, like, immediately hostile towards Quasimodo about this. Because, like, that is extremely incriminating. Because, like, how else would he have the amulet if he wasn't there when Phoebus, like...
To be fair, Quasimodo introduces himself in the scene by basically being like, okay, don't get mad at me, but...
Yeah, and somehow that works. And they don't get mad at him. Now, Gadul and Phoebus are basically like a buddy cop team trying to get an audience with the king so that Esmeralda can get pardoned. And it was at this moment where I realized that, like, the royal family is still celebrating the Dauphine's marriage, which makes me think that the time frame might be a little bit shorter than normal here.
I didn't make a note of it, but I was kind of casually trying to put the time frame together as I went, and instead of taking place over several months like in the book, I think this takes maybe about a week. The royal wedding is actually going to take place on the same day that Esmeralda is supposed to be hanged, so their hope of getting an audience with the king is obviously not great.
They, like, manage to get a pardon for Esmeralda. You know, communication was slow these days, and Esmeralda just straight up dies anyway. Like, off stage, just, we basically get, like, Phoebus going, oh my god, they're killing her. Ugh, it's too late. And that's Esmeralda's death scene.
Which is really, like, the tragedy here is that they did actually get an audience with the king, and he did pardon her. They just didn't arrive in time with the pardon. And she got killed.
Yeah, it's a scheduling issue here. It's not...
In this version, I guess they decided that trying to stage a fake hanging would be maybe too graphic, or what? Instead of seeing Esmeralda get hanged, we basically just have a scene with Frollo, where he's, like, looking off into the distance, and he's like, Yeah, they sure are hanging her over there.
Yeah, and we don't even see Esmeralda, like, as a prisoner. Like, that's usually a pretty iconic part of Esmeralda's story, is, like, her in her, like, white prison shift, you know, being sad about Phoebus. But, like, no. Esmeralda gets arrested, and then she gets killed. All of this happens offstage. Esmeralda's arguably not the focus of this one. Like, it's called Notre Dame of Paris, so you would think that the focus would maybe, like, be more centered around, like, Notre Dame and, like, what's going on at the church, you know? The climax of this one is Phoebus and Gudule trying to save Esmeralda.
Now, while they're preparing to hang Esmeralda, and while they're hanging Esmeralda, Quasimodo wants... He has the idea to do the sanctuary thing, but Frollo notices him planning something, and he's like, hey, stop that. That just fizzles out. So we get, like, the implication that there was supposed to be a sanctuary thing, but it doesn't happen. And so after it gets revealed that Frollo was really responsible for all of this, he, I guess, tries to stab Quasimodo.
And, like, we already know that Frollo, you know, he's big into stabbing. He's not good at it, but stabbing is his passion, I guess.
And so Phoebus grabs Frollo's arms and holds him back, and then, like, Quasimodo takes the dagger and stabs Frollo, and that is the end.
So this is an adaptation that starts out pretty normal and then just gets progressively weirder. The whole fourth act is, like, the drama building up towards Esmeralda being saved, and then it doesn't happen, and then Frollo also dies, and then that's it.
I almost feel like William Henry Fry was writing this, and somebody stepped in at the last minute and was like, wait a minute, can you change it to make it a tragedy? And he's like, ah, shit. I'll just take the last couple pages of the script and replace them with ones where she actually dies instead.
Yeah, I mean, there's the whole thing with, like, look, Gajul, it's your daughter after all. Let's team up and let's go to the Cane. And look, we got, like, everything that just happened is completely meaningless now.
You don't usually get, like, a race against time type of plot where they lose the race.
Which, I guess I kind of have to respect.
You definitely don't see it coming. So if we're judging the quality of the adaptation by how well it's able to throw you for a loop, this is actually ranking pretty high.
I think a lot like the Bertine opera, this, it's all about the melodrama. And here, it's not even, like, a very melodramatic melodrama. This adaptation focuses solely on the melodrama. Well, not, I didn't see any other hint of, like, a statement or a purpose to this adaptation.
Both of the adaptations that we've seen so far are, as the title suggests, Esmeralda-centric, and so there is always that kind of message of, like, don't be racist. But here, that's not really present.
Well, yeah, because it keeps in the thing about Esmeralda not being Romani after all. In this one, she dies thinking she's a gypsy. But, like, yeah, so because they keep in that element, there's not even a semblance of a, like, you couldn't even twist it to be racism is bad, which is what you can do with most other versions of Hunchback. And all of the changes that they made from the book ultimately just end up being meaningless, because Esmeralda dies, Frollo also dies. We have no idea how Quasimodo and Phoebus are gonna, like, what they're doing now.
I think maybe the intended result was for the audience to walk away going, wow, that sure was a bunch of stuff that happened on that stage there.
Yeah, and I kind of felt that with the Bertine one, too, where, it, like, oh, people want to come and see a, like, moving tragedy about this poor, like, exotic gypsy girl, and that's about it. So I kind of dislike this one for the same reasons I disliked the Bertine opera. So I came up with some questions for discussion. I don't have answers for this. If you, Ben, want to try and take a stab at some of these, I'm also leaving these open to the listener. So if you're driving around with somebody right now, feel free to, like, pause this.
Pause the tape for discussion.
Yeah, so here are my, or if some teacher is playing this in a classroom.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure they're doing that.
This extremely educational podcast where I called Frollo a sexual dom about 10 minutes ago. So it occurred to me that Quasimodo's deafness, which, like, becomes such an, like, a pretty important plot point in the book, pretty much always left out of adaptations. And so I thought, like, well, all the adaptations we've looked at so far have been of a musical nature. Most of the prominent adaptations of Hunchback that I can think of, actually, are of a musical nature. Why do you think that this story gets adapted through music so often? Does music play an important role in this story? When you think about Esmeralda's performances, Quasimodo's bell ringing, do these characters both share in creating music that they don't quite understand the power of themselves? In the sense that Quasimodo is deaf, it seems like he can maybe sort of hear the bells still, but I don't think he really... I don't know if he necessarily can appreciate the beauty of the sound. He mostly appreciates their vibrations. And Esmeralda, she sings, she dances, she performs, but in the book at least, it seems that she isn't aware of the, like, consequences that this has for her, of the effect that this has on Quasimodo, especially the effect that this has on Frollo, but the other men in her life as well.
That's a really interesting question, and it's the kind of question that you would normally answer by basically kind of saying, like, well, obviously, you know, Victor Hugo didn't intend for it to be seen that way, but possibly he did, because as we know, he participated in making the first adaptation of this book, and it was an opera. So I don't know if he necessarily had a theme of music in mind. I'd be surprised if he didn't really recognize it, at least by the time that it was becoming popular and people wanted to see it adapted. I do think that a big part of the reason why it's typically a musical is that you want to have that scene, or multiple scenes, of Esmeralda dancing, and that kind of lends itself to making the whole thing into a musical kind of production, because I don't think there are a lot of standard straight plays out there where you just break into song and dance for 5 minutes and then go back to normal.
Yeah, I do find it, as I was writing these questions for discussion, that maybe you have paused this and then played it again after I assume you had an hour-long discussion about this topic.
Yeah, so welcome back.
I find it interesting that, as you said, it may not have been a conscious choice on Victor Hugo's part, but he did decide to center a lot of the human focus of this story around two musicians, basically, in their own sense. So I also do find it interesting that Quasimodo's deafness is left out a lot of these, you know, so that he can sing and perform. I am thinking right now of a particular adaptation that keeps his deafness in mind while still being a musical, but we'll probably get to that, like, a year from now, judging by the progress we're making. So, for now, yeah, just discuss. Keep these questions in your mind as we look through probably a bunch more operas.
I've been Ben Schultz.
I've been Nora Schultz.
And you have been listening to Trying to Adapt.
Thank you.